We're going to be dealing with the last two specific applications of the universal principle of submit yourselves one to another in the fear of Christ. And under that universal principle found in Ephesians 5:21, Paul delineates three examples inside the Christian home. The first example we covered Sunday night, which is the relationship between wives and husbands. Tonight we're going to cover the relationship between children and parents, and between slaves and masters, which is also part of the home setting. So we're beginning in chapter 6, and we'll look first at verses 1 through 4. And I would like for us to read those together if we could. Children, obey your parents, for this is right. You must honor your father and your mother. This is the first commandment with a promise to make it good, so that you may prosper and live long life on earth. You parents, too, must stop exasperating your children, but continue to bring them up with the sort of education and counsel the Lord approves. Now, William's translation usually does a very good job on translating passages. I really think he could have done a better job on this one, for as we found that the Greek helped very much in understanding the exact biblical relationship between a wife and a husband, so too the grammar here and the historical background are going to have to be the spotlight that brings to the surface the truth that Paul was trying to convey about the relationship in the home between parents and children. Now, we need to understand two things. First of all, the background of the day and the place this fits in the context of the passage. In the Old Testament system, a child that spoke in an ugly or disappropriate manner to their parents was under the liability of possibly being stoned. Now that will cut back talk real quick. You just stone a few of them and they get real quiet. I don't think that happened very often. Of course, it was for very radical situations, but that showed something of the authority of the father in the Old Testament context. In the Roman context to which Paul was writing, and probably the people coming out of paganism were even more Roman in their perspective than they were, of course, Jewish. In the Roman law system, the father also had the right of life or death over children. It was a patriarchal system to the hilt. It was unimaginable, even in our day, the authority of the man or the father in the home. Children never really grew up as long as their father was alive. Their father had to die before they really had any kind of freedom that we would understand in our culture today. Our background is so different from that that automatically we have to set the stage before we can understand what's happening. Our society is one of the few societies that have elevated the place of the young person to, dare I use the term equal rights. Young people are considered to be individual with full rights in our society. And that, in putting that against the background of American individualism, which is a sign of our culture and a sign of our age, automatically puts two ram goats head to head. Our culture and their culture. So we're in a tension-filled situation before we even come to what God, through Paul, has to say in meeting the minds of these two cultures, which are diametrically opposed. One very patriarchal, one very individual-oriented. So let us know that, first of all, we're going to be very careful in our understanding of the historical background, very careful in interpreting Paul in his day, and then interpreting Paul in light of our understanding of Revelation. It's also extremely important that we parallel wives, children, and slaves. You say, oh, that's a cruddy group to be in. You know, who wants to be in that group? Those were each of the individuals that the Jewish and the Roman system tend to put down. They were on the bottom of the ladder, authority structure-wise, of the Jewish system and of the Roman system. And notice how in our day things have really switched around, And the emphasis in our culture is the freedom of the child and the word equalness is not what I want to say. And the word militancy is not what I want to say, but it's somewhere between those two, of the women movement. And I'm all for women being all they can in Jesus Christ. But I get somewhat nervous about, women's power is kind of like black power or American power. It's off balance. It's a oneness in a world of balances. So let us realize the cultural context of talking to people who are downtrodden and Paul's giving a balance to both sides. He doesn't just speak to wives, he speaks to husbands. He doesn't just speak to children, he speaks to parents. He doesn't just speak to slaves, he speaks to masters. And in the context of that, Paul is giving a balance to an unbalanced system. Children. Would you please define for me what children mean? Is that preschool? Is that below the age of bar mitzvah? Is that as long as they're home? Is that after they leave before they're married? What does the word children mean? Croak, that's difficult. I don't know what it means. I don't have a set locked in age. Nor do I have a set locked in circumstances. I know that men are called young men in Paul's culture till they're 40 years old. Well, if men are young men till 40, my soul, when does the word children leave off? If I knew exactly what children meant, I would better be able to interpret this passage, but I do not. I have to interpret it in light of my understanding. In the light of my understanding of children obey your parents, it seems like we have to make a distinction, at least as far as I'm concerned interpreting, in young people who still live at home and young people who are away from home. And yet even that doesn't do it, because nowadays, the economic system being what it is, many young people are mature adults and still living at home. So, and I can't put an age on it, because as you know, children develop at their own levels. And there's many mature junior high young people. And there's many unmature college people. So I can't put an age on it, and I can't put a situation on it. So I don't know exactly what I'm talking about when I do say children. But if I had to define it, I would say those still at home. Obey your parents. Now, my translation left out a phrase that I think is absolutely indispensable. It's in P46, the Chester Beatty Papyri. It's in Aleph. It's not in base, but it's in Aleph. Two good Greek manuscripts. And I think "in the Lord" has got to be in there. I thought he went crazy when he left it out. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. What does the word obey mean? Does the word obey have the connotation of a despotic authority that at whose snap of the fingers we must jump? The word obey is in the same context as submit yourself. It is a word that speaks of being under authority. It is a present imperative. It means as a manner of life, as a habitual way of who you are, obey. Now the Greek word to obey is made of two words. It's made of the preposition under and of the verb to hear. So the word means to hear under, and the implication being to hear under the authority that God has given. Children, how would that defined? Submit yourselves. That could be the same context with all three. Listen with view to authority as to the Lord parents. Now, does that mean Christian parents? Should a child obey a child who is a Christian and old enough to know the difference between right and wrong, always obey a non-Christian parent? I don't think that Paul would ever, ever say to anyone that when we come to the age to have Christian convictions, that we should listen to any authority above that of Christ. You say, but parents are the authority. We need to see this in the context of Matthew chapter 10, verses 34 through 39, the same context we saw husbands and wives and everything in. Wives submit and everything. That is the area where Jesus said, I came not to bring peace, but to bring a sword. And to put a man against his own son, and a son against his own father, and a daughter against her mother, and a mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law. And a man's enemies will be members of his own household. There comes a time when the priority choice of Jesus has to be made over anything, including parents. Now, as I say that, everybody wants to start hitting me with this situation or that situation. So here's the place that I must say openly and unashamedly, we are talking about the ideal. We are talking about Christian parents and committed Christian children. We are talking about the ideal of which none of us ever reach. You say, what if the parent is not a Christian? Or what if one of the parents is not a Christian? Or what if the child is not yet a Christian? I can't answer all those questions. They're not in the biblical record. And for me to answer all those questions would be to put Bob's understanding of how to rear children, which you don't want, and I'm exasperated in myself. So I can't answer all the implications of that, but I do say obey your parents has got to be qualified as submit to your husbands, and everything has to be qualified. It can't mean in everything, and it can't mean always obey your parents, no matter what. So I'm qualifying two things that must be qualified in the light of the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Now, not rebellion, and not what they want, but in the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Okay. Obey and continue to obey your parents, for this is right. What does it mean, this is right? Culturally acceptable? One commentator I read named Weiss says it means righteous. This is the way the Old Testament law requires it. That's possible, but it's not used that way much. A parallel passage is Colossians 3:20, which always seems to add light as we look back and forth from Colossians to Ephesians, where it says, children, practice obedience to your parents in everything, for this is acceptable in Christians. And I think a little more, this is acceptable and well-pleasing to God. I think it's right. We're talking to the kids, not the parents. We're not saying to the parents, this is generally accepted, this is the right conduct. We're talking to the kids. And we say to the kids, we're not talking about any kid, but we're talking about Christian kids. Kids in the Lord. Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. And the Colossians passage says, obedience is well pleasing to God. You say, God doesn't have my parents. We're not talking about, at the moment, the quality of the parents. We're not talking about the appropriateness of their discipline. We're not talking about the reasonableness of their understanding of your age. We're not talking about whether they are in Christ or out of Christ or growing Christians or inactive Christians. We're not talking about the parents at all. We're simply saying to young people that God's will for a Christian young person, and whatever you want to find that age again, is to obey your parents in the Lord. Now that's the command. It's a present imperative. But it does not stop there. And it's given an Old Testament hanger to hang your hat on. So we're going to have a little more information about what obedience, how it's related to Christianity and God's will. When it says, you must honor your father and your mother. Now, you must honor is another present imperative, another command that speaks of continual lifestyle action. Now, I have limited the word obey. I limited it in the priority of Jesus Christ. I will not limit the word honor. There is a limit to obedience in either leaving home or becoming old enough to make up your own decisions or becoming led by the Lord to do something that might disagree with parental authority. There is some limits to that, obey. But there is no limit to the word honor. For even though a child may leave home, and even though a child may be in middle age, the command from the Decalogue of the Ten Commandments is, you must continually honor your parents. What does that mean? We're not talking about submitting to authority anymore. We're talking about attitude. We're talking about perspective. We're talking about way of looking at something. The word in Greek means to give something its appropriate weight, to estimate something to its proper value. When I was a young person at home, I did not see anything particularly valuable about Christian parents. Matter of fact, it was a hang-up. But now, as I have got older and had kids of my own, I see an inestimable weight and value to Christian parents that I never saw before. Honor is an attitude that puts proper weight or a proper value on something. And I am just now at 32 understanding the value of parents, at least one parent. I only had one that I related to. At least a parent that loved Jesus Christ. And the honor that I have for them of what they did for me, though they've made mistakes and had faults, and though they did it in a bad way many times, my command from God through Paul is, Bob, always give them the weight that's due them until I take them home. I don't care how old I get, or how obnoxious my parents get, or how sick they get, or how far they get, or how wrong I think they are, I am to have an attitude of reverent respect for those people that God let me come through their physical union all the days of my life. Then, it links to that mother and father. Now, isn't it beautiful that the Old Testament puts an equality in the home between mother and father? It doesn't just say father here, it says father and mother. We're to honor both of them. You say, well, you don't know what my old man's like. You don't know what my mother's like. We're not talking about parents right now. We're talking about kids. We're not talking about what if, what could be, what may be. We're not talking about the optimum situation. We're talking about God's will for young people. And it's two things, obey and honor. Both present imperative. Now, it says this is the first commandment with a promise to make it good. Now, the word the first, does every translation here have the first? Anybody have a first? Does anybody have anything but the first commandment with a promise? Spanish doesn't either, has a definite article. Everyone here has a definite article. The Greek does not have a definite article. And the problem is, this is not the first commandment with a promise, nor is it the only commandment with a promise. What does it mean when it says first commandment with a promise? Some people say, well, it means the first one the kids learn. Well, that's very interpretive. You think that with no article, words take on the quality. Could it mean this is a commandment of first importance? This is a priority commandment? I think so. There's no article with first. It's simply an author. This is a first quality kind of commandment with a promise to make it good. What promise? Here it is. Verse 3. So that you may prosper and live long on the earth. This is a quote from Exodus 20:12 and Deuteronomy 5:16 with one change. Now, before I get into that specific, I want to do a little aside, a little theological parenthesis. Paul is speaking in what is well-pleasing to the Lord in the life of young people. And in the midst of that, he places the sixth commandment, or the first commandment of the second half of the Decalogue that relates to each other. We have always said that we are under grace, not under law. We have always said that in Jesus Christ, that the law is not the way to relate to God. We are not right with God by keeping the law, and the Old Testament is never the way anymore to have salvation or to win God's favor. That only comes through Jesus Christ's death and our acceptance of that. But that never meant to say the Old Testament is abrogated or done away with or invalid or not central in our understanding of how God wants us to live. Here Paul is going back to the Ten Commandments to say this is well-pleasing to God for your life. So never, now we have to interpret the Old Testament, and we have to decide what's valid and what's not in that system. But I say to you, at least the Ten Commandments are God's will for society. And any society that will follow that as a general rule will be a prosperous, long, and stable society. Matter of fact, the very fact where it says, if you honor your father and mother, your days will be long, is that saying that if you honor or respect or have a reverent attitude, not saying you agree with them, have a reverent attitude to them all of your life, is that saying you'll live a long time? No. In the context of the commandment, it says, that you will, it will be well with you in the land that the Lord your God has given you. Now, Paul changed that to earth. In the context, it was a promise to Israel that if she maintained the priority of family structure, she would be a healthy society. That promise is a promise to a society and to a culture and not to an individual. Because if you'll look at that phrase, you'll know that phrase, in the land, be well with you in the land the Lord thy God has given you, is used many times in the book of Deuteronomy in different contexts than personal promises. And so what we have here is a promise to a society, not a promise to an individual. Now, notice what it says in verse 4. We're going to the parents. Paul talked to the women first because the women were downtrodden in Paul's day. Paul talked to the children first because the children were downtrodden. They were under the authority. Did you know that if a Roman father did not pick up his child, that child was put out on the dump heap or left to starve or placed in the town square and anybody could pick up and raise? That was the kind of life and death that children had to depend on their parents. Now, in that kind of culture where children have no rights and no honor unless the parents happen to want them, or if it's the right sex, most male babies were saved, most female babies were discarded. Put on a dump heap to starve. That was the way they were handled. That was first century abortion. And now, he turns to the ones who had all the authority when he says in verse 4, you parents too must stop exasperating your children. Now, I told the young people they had two requirements under Jesus Christ, and that was to obey with the one condition that it did not violate their relationship to Jesus Christ, or their priority relationship with God first. And number two, they were to honor all their life. Now, I'm going to turn from those two admonitions to them about God's will in every situation, in any culture, and I'm going to turn to the parents for a moment. And Paul says something very pointed to the parents when he says, stop exasperating your children. It is a present imperative with a may article, which means stop an act already in process. They were, I think the King James has bringing their children to wrath. What does it have exactly? What? Provoking your children to wrath. The word there means to bring to anger, to exasperate, to be so heavy-handed upon that it breaks them. Parents are not gods to their children. Parents are not the final authority in all things to their kids. Parents, ideally, are stewards of the love and grace of God. And we are responsible for the stewardship that we give in the life of our children. Stop, as a matter of life, exasperating your children. Now, but continue to bring them up. This word, continue to bring him up, is another present imperative. Man, Paul is making commands here. As an apostle, bring them up. That's the same word that was used in 5:29 for husbands and wives. And my translation has the word, but he feeds and fosters it, meaning his own body, which is really the way he ought to love his wife. And I told you it meant to feed something to maturity. Parents are to so deal with their children in the same way that husbands are to deal with their wives, and that is to bring out all the God-given potential of that individual life. They are to mature their children in the Lord in all that God wants for that young person's life. So the only thing, parents, that you got on your kid is about 20 years. That's all you got on them. There's no other. You have nothing over them but a few years. You're not more smart than they. You're not more spiritual than they. You're not more culturally in than they. You're nothing more than them except 20 years experience. Out of that experience, develop in them a love for God and bring to fruition all the God-given talents in that young life. And only by that will we be stewards of the children God has given us. Feed to maturity. And then it goes on. With the sort of education and counsel the Lord approves. Now, Williams gets very off there. The first word is the word discipline. And it's the word that means discipline with specific punishment. Means spare the rod, spoil the child. Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm not nervous about corporal punishment.
I think corporal punishment is a normal, biblical part of child rearing. But let me stop right there. And let me say that Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 and following says that corporal punishment is also the way God deals with parents. Now you keep telling your kids, I'm doing it for your good. Hurts me more than it does you. Well, next time you get in a tight scrape, I want you to think that God does the same thing for you. Same thing that you do for your kids, God does for you. Read Ephesians 12, 5 and following. Discipline is for a purpose. Now, when you start blacking the eyes of your kids and wringing their arms till they come out of socket, maybe you didn't read the Bible well enough. It said, spare the rod, not the club. You know, there's balance in all this. Discipline, specific acts of discipline. And then it says, counsel. And this word means to instruct with words, to admonish. Martin Luther, Daddy beat him very badly as a child. Very strict parent. No leniency. Very, very strict. When Luther got to be old enough to talk and to realize what had happened, he said, the rod, yes, but put an apple by the rod when they're good. You see, all beatings, after a while, tend to lose all their purpose. Instruct with the rod, yes. And counsel with the word, yes. Yes. Both. And then it had a little phrase that I like very much. It says, of the Lord. Now, does that mean the counsel and instructions and the disciplines of the Lord and not of us as parents? Yes. It really bothers me as a parent that I discipline most of the time out of irritation, not out of principle. Most of the time I correct my kids because they're getting on my nerves. And I don't like what they're doing, and it bothers me, and so they get it. Instead of disciplining for right and wrong, or what's appropriate and what's inappropriate for a Christian young person. Now, I would imagine you're in the same boat as I am. And I stand in a condemnation for that. And I listened to my sermon, Peggy, about whenever we did it last, and I was going to try to work on it, and I hadn't done a very good job at it. I still punish out of irritability. And I hope that God will give me the grace to punish, not out of irritability, but out of biblical principle. And the reason I punish is not because they irk me or make me mad, because this will help them be a better Christian when they get older. And the instruction should not be mine, it should be God's instruction. And I hope that for you too. Now, I want to mention a couple of things before I move on from here. Number one, that this is Old Testament through and through. This Paul's not getting this off the wall. This is not New Testament. This comes from Deuteronomy 11, 18 through 21. It comes from Deuteronomy 6, 7. It comes from more Old Testament quotes than I could quote. The Old Testament says that the place of education for Christian young people is the church. Is that right? It's a school. Society. Home. Sunday school will never take the place of a Christian home. Never. School will never take the place of a Christian home. Society's rights or wrongs or norms will never take the place. And if you want to get really Old Testament, it's not just the mother's job. The priority place of religious instruction in the Old Testament is the job of the father. And the mother supports, and the mother does. But the priority and structural base in the Old Testament is the father. Now, we have missed that as a culture. We send them to church to get a little bit about the Bible. We send them to school to get about the world. And then we gripe at both because it's not what we want. If you don't like what your kids are being taught here, have you ever sat down at home with your kids and taught them the Bible? Ever. Do you ever tell stories at home? Do you ever discuss anything spiritual at home? Do you ever answer questions that come up in Sunday school at home? You cannot be all that God wants you to be as a parent unless you're willing to take the responsibility of spiritual instruction of your children. Okay? Let's move on to the next relationship, which I think, without too much abuse, I'm going to make analogous to employer-employee. But notice it's slaves to masters.
Notice also that slaves were a part of the general culture of Paul's day, and Paul did not attack slavery ever. Not one place in all the Bible is Paul negative to slavery. I said, why? Could it be that submit yourselves to governmental authority is a principle that, of course, we don't like it in America because it doesn't fit our ideal of equal rights and equal opportunity and all that. But folks, God says that we're to work in the system in which we're found. Tonight we want to say, Christians in Russia, why don't y'all get with it and evangelize? They work in the system in which they find themselves. And they have to work in that system. And to rebel against the slavery of Rome would have meant that Christianity would have been stomped out by the sword very early. Paul did not attack slavery, but Paul attacked the attitude of slavery, which finally brought slavery down. And that was looking at people as things and not as brothers. So Christianity deals in the realm of ideologies and principles. And these ideologies and principles can bring down the strongest government if they're applied in love across the board. But we never have, there is no such thing as a holy war in Christianity. You know, fighting for America in the name of God is a dubious honor at best. Now, slaves, you must practice obedience. Present imperative. Man, Paul just links them all over the place. As a manner of your life, you must obey your earthly masters. Now, really the word here is fleshly. Now, usually Paul means this in a bad sense, but here he means it just physical. Your earthly masters. Now, you say, well, he just means if they're Christian masters, or if they're not Christian masters, or he just means that they're good employers. Well, 1 Peter 2:18 says that, in the sense it says, whether they're good or bad, you obey them in the Lord. So see, the question about my parents don't understand is not relevant to Paul. Paul's not saying, here's the situation, if it's good, do it. He's saying, this is what ought to be done in every situation, and there are no exceptions to the rule. But I know he'd say, boy, I feel sorry for you, and I'll pray for you, and I'll love you. But this is what we do. We submit to the good ones and the bad ones because of Jesus, not because of them. You don't obey your parents because of them. You obey your parents because you're in the Lord. You don't love your masters and serve them because who they are. You do it because you're in the Lord. You don't love your wife as Christ loved the church because she's so deserving of it, but because you're in the Lord. You don't submit to your husband because he's so wonderful, but because you're in the Lord. And in the Lord governs every interpersonal relationship of life. Now, with reverence and fear, does that mean that we ought to be afraid and cowering and trembling? Well, it seems like that, but let me give you three other places it's used in different contexts. That's not, can't be what it means. It's used in 1 Corinthians 2:3. It's used in 2 Corinthians 7:15, it's used in Philippians 2:12, in different contexts, in different ways, so it doesn't mean terrified, cowering fear. It may mean reverential respect. With sincerity of heart, it's really sincerity of psuche, soul. It really means singleness of mind. It means don't serve them and say, boy, you son of a gun, if I ever get away from you, boy, I'll be glad. If I ever get out of this job, man, I tell you what, that stinking business. With singleness of heart means you serve them out of one priority. What is that priority? Hourly paycheck? Good working conditions? They gave me a new insurance policy? They smile at me every year? Jesus. That's the singleness of heart. We serve. And I will tell you, I think it'll apply to employee and employer. You know, if your boss has got to run around and check on your job to see if you're doing a kind of a quality job, and if you just wait to work, and it's going to get to about men-pleasing and eye-pleasing, if you just work good because folks are looking at you, and you just do what you have to get by, and if you can lay around a couple of minutes and not work and get off early, then you're just tickled back. I want to tell you, that is an inferior relationship, an employer and employee that's not pleasing to God. Christians ought to be the very best employees they can possibly be. No question. Quality workmen. Always giving a full day for a full wage. As you would obey Christ. There's the singleness again, and I want to show you two other places. Look down in verse 6 where it says, trying to carry out the will of God, and looking down the next phrase in verse 7, as though it were the Lord and not for me. And there's one basis for us doing quality everything. Quality love to a wife, quality love to children, quality work to employer, quality relationships in Sunday school, quality deaconship,
quality preaching. We ought to do everything in quality because of Jesus. Everything we do ought to be the best that we can possibly do. Not because of circumstances or because it's best, because it's good or we'll get promoted or people pass them back, because of Jesus. We ought to be the best we can possibly be in every area because of Christ. Notice where it says, not serving men as though they were watching you, but as true slaves of Christ. Aha. How many of us put on our best foot forward when the boss is around? There's a word for that, but I forgot it. Matter of fact, a good place to look at the balance of that is Romans 14:7-9. Romans 14:7-9. It goes on. Verse 8, for you know that everyone, slave or free, will get his reward from the Lord for anything good that he does. Now let's go back real quick. Will there be reward for Christians? The same Bible that talks about judgment is the same Bible that talks about rewards. Now I don't understand why in the world God would give us reward for something that's only possible through his grace anyway, but he is. And the same way we're going to build with wood, hay, and stubble is the same way by grace we're going to build with jewels, precious stone, and all that. And the same way we're going to lose those things that have been selfish is the same way we're going to keep those things that have been for him. There will be a reward. 2 Corinthians 5:10. God will recompense to every man according to his deeds. Now, I don't understand that, but I'm glad. And you know, it's going to be just like us to get to heaven and start counting the number of diamonds that other people have. Isn't it? First thing, walk in the door, I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. How many do you got? Oh, you only have 5. Well, you must have been a spiritual crumb, you know. I hope we're delivered from that, but I don't know. Anything good he has done, does that mean anything spiritual? Certainly that means anything for the church, right? That must be anything we witness. Anytime we give, is that what it means? Quote, no. The whole context here is not spiritual things. The whole context is what? The workplace. The home. You mean that I have a reward for living in a proper relationship to my wife and kids? Yes. You mean I have a reward for working in a certain quality and way? Yes. There is no secular and sacred. You know, we think that witnessing is really spiritual, but building a house is not. You know, we'll get rewarded for witnessing, but we don't get nothing but a good house for building. I say to you, there is a spiritual blessing from the Lord in quality work as well as there is in ministry. Does that mean that those of you who don't happen to be vocational ministers can have the same kind of spiritual blessing as those of us who do, quote, religious things? I think it does. Number 9, you slave owners. Now, Paul didn't stop, did he? He went right on with it. By the way, the word reward, I think, is interpreted by Colossians 3:24, which says, we have an inheritance from the Lord, which speaks of salvation. You slave owners or masters, too, must maintain the proper attitude toward your slaves. You know what the key? You know what the key to Christianity is? You say, program, budget, building, baptism, baloney. All B's, aren't they? The key to the Christian life in every aspect is attitude, motivation, the inside, the why behind the what. And we're just going bananas looking at what's everywhere when God looks at the whys of everything. Now, slave owners said, well, God said I had to love you, you little slave you, so I guess I will. I won't be so mean to you anymore because Jesus told me not to. That's not it. That's not the deal. It's the attitude of heart that God looks at in every relationship of the Christian life. He goes on, slave owners, you must maintain, present imperative, the same attitude towards your slaves. Stop threatening them. It's a present word that means stop, it means to loosen up. If something's real tight, you ever get your stomach just real tight or your neck, and you can feel it loosen when the pressure's off. That's what it's, that loosening of something. You better work or I'm going to beat you with an inch of your life. If you don't work, I'm going to cut off your ear. You know, on and on. They were threatening them to get the job done, threatening them to get quality work, threatening to get production. No, that's not the way you're supposed to do it. And I want to say again, this is as radical a statement to slave owners as it was to husbands, as it was to parents. Paul is saying something to a culture that did not want to hear it when he said, husbands, you must love. And he was saying something to parental authority that parents didn't want to hear when he said, stop exasperating. And he's saying something to slave owners they didn't want to hear when he said, quit acting that way. Radical, radical statement in today. Stop threatening them, for you know that their real Lord and yours in heaven, and he never shows partiality. Close with this. Every earthly barrier that men put up, I'm better than those niggers, I'm better than those Mexicans, I'm better than those Italians, I'm better than those chinks, every earthly barrier, they don't have the education I have, they don't have my degree, they haven't been to my school, every earthly barrier, they don't dress like me, they don't live in my part of town, they don't drive my kind of car, they don't have my kind of thing, every earthly barrier is non-existent to the eyes of God. God knows no partiality between human beings. He does not know male, female. He does not know Jew, Greek. He does not know slave, free. He does not know nationality. He does not know economic level or IQ. Every barrier we put between people, God is colorblind to. Now think about that next time one of those thoughts come to your mind. And please, save your racial jokes. I just don't like them. Questions or comments? It applies to the individual. What it is? No, I'm saying that it is an individual command with cultural blessings. Every individual must honor father and mother, no question. But the why is not so they'll live longer, but that they'll be in the land longer, which means a national entity. Oh, yeah, I think it applies to other nations as Paul reinterprets it, saying it's in the land the Lord thy God gave you to the earth. You know, to the earth. But I don't think it's individual. I wouldn't say, Phil, that there's no individual element, but I would say the primary interest is cultural or societal. Because I think practically speaking, all of us have known folks who are very devoted to their parents, very devoted, but have died through accidents or through many things. Some of the commentators I read handled this, they said, this is one blessing toward longevity to which others need to be combined. They would say, don't smoke, because that'll get your lungs all grouped up. Watch what you eat, exercise, you know, don't overeat, don't have too much pressure at work. And combined with that, some other, this kind of thing would give long life. Others say it's a manner of living. If you love your parents, you probably have a congenial spirit and you'll live longer. None of that relates to me like the little phrase, in the land the Lord thy God gives you, which when we went to Deuteronomy, it's used five or six other times in totally different contexts to talk about cultural promises to Israel and never to individuals in other contexts. It's why I do that. So I'm relating that little phrase to its other uses. But I could be as wrong as I could be. There's no guarantee on that one. That was free for those who give the cooperative program. All right. Let me say something that I said the other night in a different context. Some people, if you leave here and you say, well, I was terrific, I had to stay in here and say, you think you? Bob didn't understand what my situation is. Bob didn't understand, know my parents. Bob didn't know what I'm going through. You're right. But Bob didn't like that. God made you some authoritative commands. He said, my will for your life, for you to be pleasing to me, is to obey and to honor. Now, what if you were a slave, young people, and someone else owned your body, life, and soul? They had to force you to do anything they wanted you to do. Anything they wanted you to do, you had to do. Paul told that same group to obey. You see? And that was God's will for them. God's will for you is a rest.